Welcome to the second talk of the fifth edition of Human Entities. This is just a quick note to say that happily we're not wearing masks, and we are able to do that because we are on open air, and also that in the after the talk we can also offer you a glass of wine. For those of you who smoke, we ask you just to smoke nearer the trees, and at the end, the way out would be through that little door there on the right. Okay, I'll pass now to Jared.
Thank you very much for coming. Well, we're CADA. I'm Jared Hawkey. This is Sophia Oliveira. And as organisers of this event, we must thank the DG Arts for its financial support. CADA would also like to thank our fantastic partner, the Lisbon Architecture Triennale, for hosting and promoting the event. And we're also especially grateful to our supporters, that is the Lisbon City Council and Professor Nuno Correia at Nova Links Universidad at Nova de Lisboa. And we must also thank Chloe Gastine, who works with CADA and was involved in the research. And finally, Alessandra Strilla, for accepting our invitation to participate. So the reason why we've invited Alessandra Strilla here this evening is to talk about his collaboration with scientists. What we believe makes his experiments special is the way that they transcend what is normally expected from such relationships. Because although the boundaries between art and science are increasingly porous, and many of today's encounters between the two disciplines are much more than artists illustrating scientific information, still, genuinely hybrid collaborations where exchanges are based on mutual understanding are far less common. Obviously, due to the specialisation within science, it's very rare for an artist to be involved in how a scientific research problem is framed or approached. The second reason for inviting Alessandra is the quality of the resulting artwork, which is truly remarkable. Equally conceptual and poetic, at a fundamental level, much of his artwork operates across the three domains of human culture: science, art, and life. Finally, as Alessandra rarely chooses to appear in public, we are particularly honoured to welcome him here this evening. Alessandra Strilla's work is an investigation into the essences of images that expands spatially and temporally through different media. In his videos and installations, Strilla examines the subject's psychological reactions to images and their interaction with matter. Amongst many other recent solar exhibitions include A Third Reason, which opened last week at Rialto here in Lisbon, All and Everything at the Rufino Tamayo Museum in Mexico City in 2020, Metal Herlin at the Fondation Gulbenkian in Paris in 2019, Capsules de Silencio at the Reina Sofia Museum, Madrid. And his next show, Flat Bells, will be shown at MoMA in New York in 2022. Thank you, Alessandra.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, just to start, I don't know where to start in a way, but
okay.
we were talking when you came in about the image that you chose,
okay,
which we were particularly curious about because I did a Google image search on it and I couldn't find it. But then you were telling me that this was the first computer image.
Okay, so yeah. Like, thank you for the flawless introduction. And I'm really pleased that, you know, one of the reasons I accepted this conversation, first of all, is because I hope this will be a warm conversation with you guys. And but when you decided, like, when you asked for an image, you know, I thought about that image of sort of like a vectorial image of a samurai. That it was always puzzled me as being, because it's one of the entrances of the Encyclopedia Luso-Americana for what is the first computer, of the first drawing made by a computer. And for me, the choice of a samurai was always puzzling. And so for years, this image haunted me. And every time, always inside, like every time, you know, this could be like an incredible portrait of myself, because years after discovering this image, I decided to trace the vectorial lines made by the computer. Actually, what was also interesting is that in the Enciclopedia Luso-Americana, the entrance comes for ordenador and not computador. And I love the idea that first, like I guess it was in the 60s or 50s, late 50s, that was this change from like a, also from like a dominant culture like French or something like ordinateur, that mm-hmm. it moves to computer, mm-hmm. but also the way of organizing from computerizing or, you know.
It was also a movement from people being computers to machines being computers.
So, and I love the idea of like at that time that I was really like tracing like these lines of what if the computer can draw, what were like this, the choice of portraits. As when you say like it's a computer, a drawing by a computer, what's behind it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I thought that for this conference would be
it's perfect
to become. Yeah. And then lately, and this is why I'm a bit dizzy, because I tried to make the same, because years after I made also my I found by chance that image was made by one of a pioneer. There is not credit in the encyclopedia. Mm. By a pioneer of computer art. And I was just before coming here, because the question could come. So, and I'm slightly like dizzy, like for trying to find, you know, who's the credits for the image that I couldn't find. But that, if you want, I'll try myself, you know, to.
But I have to say, this dizziness must be fairly common, because Alexandra's work is always a deep investigation. And to be quite honest, sometimes I don't know how you produce work.
I want, you know, to people to be uncomfortable, not myself.
Right.
So the idea is like on the same when I'm actually searching for things, there's this like these images that have this resonance. And they stay for years. In this case, it's been like, you know, I don't know how many years. This image is in my... And it was already settled, you know, actually.
But this is the first time you've used it, right?
Yeah, like... Okay. Yeah, I used it for an actual piece.
Okay.
It exists. It was supposed to be an edition, but I doubt that I'm going to retrace it many times. Knowing now, because in the beginning I thought it was anonymous. It was this computer, you know, and knowing mm-hmm. that it was done by an artist, I doubt that now I want to, like, follow the traces of the artist and not the computer, because mm-hmm. at that moment it was like a virgin territory, or, you know. So, but yeah. So the thing is, like, there are some images that haunt me for years. Mm-hmm. And those become somehow like, as we're talking about previously, perception traps. So mm-hmm.
So what do you mean by that, perception traps?
So first they trap my perception, right. My attention, and then I go deep into it, and suddenly this is like a Ezra Pound like definition of what art could be. It's and it becomes a resonant image where ideas fall. Mm-hmm. So then ideas start to fall mm-hmm. in. So it's like I find coincidences, and the more I go, and the idea, the more it grows, the more it becomes independent, and at a certain moment it gains autonomy, hopefully, mm-hmm. and then I like other people start to find things that I've never seen before, you know. So they're also trapped in my, but in the beginning, and it's kind of interesting now that I've. Two other pieces were showing at the Berard Foundation that I was much more aggressive in setting these traps because mm-hmm. I really wanted people to be like in the room, you know, isolated, like focusing, mm-hmm. you know, and I wanted to split their attention, their perception, and from that moment on, just to study like the behavior towards. Or mm-hmm. like the images, or like this matter.
Okay. I don't know. It seemed obvious to start with your exhibition at Rialto Seix. So maybe if you could describe that work. It's called A Third Reason, and it opened last Wednesday.
Yeah.
And maybe that includes perceptual traps too, right?
Yeah. So, like, the show and the way it was, I was the show is divided, like, it's two pieces that I'm presenting there.
But it's got one name, right?
One name.
Okay.
So it's just like one piece gives the tone to the entire. But there is this, how should I start? There's this idea of creating an infinite poem that Brian Geisen, you know, was one of the pioneers in it, doing it. And when he was starting, like in the beginning, he was working with this Jens Somerville,
and he was a mathematician.
Trying to use computers to create this algorithm that would, like, you know, expand the semantic and grammatical potential of a sentence, and so this was done. But in the beginning, what it started like was like pairing two ideas. One, what if I have a poem or a sentence that can, by like doing a cut up done by a computer, that's like I'm not involved in it, that somehow would unleash like this like hidden truths, like the cut up process that Burroughs and Geisen were doing. Mm-hmm. And the other idea, if the poem becomes infinite, somehow it would go and fill the shelves of Borges' infinite shelf, like in a library at the Babel library. And so it started like I really enjoyed the idea of you have a library of a single poem, of a permutating poem that grows at the same speed as the library itself, mm-hmm. as the short story talks about. Mm-hmm. And so there was this image that I remember, and this was the trap. It's a stripe where you see Borges in front of his library, supposedly library, with these triangles. And I have this habit of every time I see an image, it's almost like a cinetic idea that every single image, if you put it running like a scroll, it's also some like it unleashes things, energy, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to pair two things. Well, so like, what if I put this image scrolling at a certain speed, mm-hmm. to the sound of an infinite poem? So it's run by the poem is being permutated, and suddenly it runs. It's a bit difficult for people that haven't seen it, you know. But I'm trying to. So you have a voice saying a poem, and then you have an image that falls down of Borges, mm-hmm. you know, and then it goes and it follows.
It's like a scroll.
It's a scroll.
It's kind of moving like that.
Yeah.
Constantly coming down.
And so the speed varies, and so, but everything is controlled by this voice. And then I found out I found the right sentence for this scroll. It's a sentence by Genesis P. Orridge that somehow has this relation to a mirror, and also that works. Like when you start permutating the images, when I was young, there were two reasons for me to look in the mirror. One was to see if my parting was straight. The second reason was to see if my tie was straight. Now that I'm older, there's a third reason. And then when you permutate it, you can go and say like somehow it becomes almost like a biographic poem. So when I was one, because Genesis is like the story is a bit dramatic. Like he fell in love in the 80s, and then it's like he fused with his her partner, and they start like doing like this we started with what is with how do you say
plastic surgery.
They start like mirroring each other, and when they sort of like balance themselves, she dies, and so he gets the permanent image of the partner in himself. And so in the poem, by permutating, it's like when I was one or when I was two, there were reasons, and then it goes on. And the idea that if I was going through, also it's kind of interesting that Genesis Peorage was like it has the legacy of Ryan Geisen. And so everything suddenly started to make sense.
And sorry, he was given given all of his work.
Yeah.
Right.
And so suddenly you have like this sentence that makes sense, you know, permutating. We are living, it's no longer just like a straightforward algorithm, but you have like the possibility with our meanings today of having artificial intelligence working for this. So having a collaboration with Gonçalo Raposo from Technic, from this natural language laboratory, to work on this on the poem, and then you have like this all this like incredible like coincidences that start like that the poem start the unleash, and by doing this, the voice also works, and it's sort of controls the speeds and the zoom of the image. Okay. And it becomes so frantic that suddenly not only you have this Bitnik experiment in the permutation, but also the Bitnik experiment in the dream machine, because then the image becomes geometric, creates patterns, and it becomes like one of the machines that they were working for years, a machine of light, a light machine that stimulates your brain waves.
You've got your eyes closed.
Yeah. And so there's actually one or two displayed at Museu do Chiado now, originals. It's kind of interesting that it's at the same moment that I'm working on this someone, you know, put them on display, and Ryan Geisen's work is also at Museu do Chiado. It's like it's a bless.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know if I.
Yeah, no. I think that's clear. There's another piece in the show as well, right, which is a.
So the second goes also on. There is this because the show has two poles. One like is this the Bitniks, almost like a neo dada, and the other is surrealism, because. One of the image of Roger Kewa book of stones, he has this beautiful stone called ruined marble, and it's a landscape. It's sort of slices of marble that come from Italy that display. But this is completely fake. They display this like fake landscape of the desert.
And so the image on the book is
the image of one of these stones. Okay. It's the Book of Stones, right, where he talks about his own collection. It's a really interesting book. And then, so the book had this. It's a kind of interesting book, and I was like thinking about it. Was really interesting because like becomes these stones are meditation stones. Like you meditate on the details, becomes like these color stones that are stones that. The Chinese have schools of studying the details and they're reorganizing the world according to these details. And I always thought like that this is an incredible meditation system. And by chance, since I was 10 years old, that I have my own ruined marble stone, like this Pietra Paesina is the name of the stone. And then I found out that, you know, Kewa has this. And I thought, like, I was to be incredible to have to work on this image. And And the idea is, like, the more I look, I'm losing sight, but I remember all the details of the stone. And so I asked, you know, for, you know, someone to photograph it on a, with, on a macroscopic level. And it has these trees and this, all these details that actually they're all fake. There are no trees. There are no, like, stones. There's no desert. There's no landscape. It's just natural things that happen in the stone or during the formation of the stone or during, like, the sedimentation of the you know, the all the chemical things that happen in the magnesium. I don't know, all the processes. But
they look like little ferns.
Yeah. It's really
interesting. Them pseudo-fossils.
There's a poster of the show. I displayed the two things, and if you want to see. And so the idea, as Max Ernst collages, I always thought it would be really incredible if I could do, with the technology we have today, of doing like an endless collage of landscapes. So seeing something that you really know very well, suddenly by displaying all this or bringing to the front like different levels of zooms, you'd create new compositions. Mm-hmm. And so what I did in collaboration with Borja Caro, it's the person I work with for this kind of like a computer like a computer-based work, was to like, what if we do like this horizontal scroll, like we put slices of the image, like almost like tectonic plates of the stone, and we'd bring them to the front aleatorically. And by doing this, it would create new like new patterns, new like compositions, like always different, that would be also like that could also be like triggered by sound. And for this, ask Gabriel Ferrandini to collaborate with us. So we did the first attempt, and this was our exchange, was at Gulbenkian at the amphitheater. We did a small, like a sort of a live show. And the idea was, let's do it, because he asked me to do some like a background for his concert. Okay, I'll do this, and then I'll take your sound, and I'll make a piece out of it. So first, my images are just background, and then the second moment, it's your sound becomes the trigger, and the image is the image become part of a sculpture, because I'm part of my work is related to ways of making image concrete. And so this is what happened, but it was we had some technical problems. We couldn't record anything live. And so Gabriel actually was generous enough to give us some samples of sounds that we use it in also aleatorically. So you have Gabriel playing aleatoric, and he plays, and this, and what he does, he unveils like layers, stones, you know, like almost like sedimentary like material that combines in unexpected ways, and most of them in like aesthetically interesting like ways. Yeah. So this is two. So I have to, the two pieces work in somehow like they're animated by computer. They're two, almost like two, they're traps because they want your attention as much as possible. And one is works as a, they're like, they founded in very basic principles of artistic principles. One is a portrait or a study on a portrait. The other is the study on landscape. One has a connection with like self-meditating, like a mirrored, processes of like and the other is a meditation on landscape, you know. So it's just like one horizontal, another vertical, and somehow, and we tried to do this because I did this poster with Annabelle Lise,
And it's like that the poster also, it's two things that were never meant to be together, but somehow they work. And that when those things work like in this parallel way, and this is the way we're talking about like art and science, it's a fractal. So it's like it becomes like the unit of the rest of the world, the work, you know. It's just this singularity of like of this is working like in parallel. It's somehow it can open up for the rest, you know, the way I work with science and or the way I work with other things, you know, or with design, or you know, it's like stuff that somehow doesn't lose identity. You know, I'm always in my own mind, my own world, you know, but also it works with at the same pace and at some point it becomes stagent.
Mm-hmm. I was saying that you wrote about this exhibition, is there in the poster, it's an experiment on the limits of computational creativity.
Okay.
So I just would like you to explain why do you think you've reached that limit, especially because given what you now explain, that you find it really attractive that you can use computation to create infinity.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've explained how you use combinatory algorithms,
okay,
on the image and everything. You also said you use random as a strategy for infinite diversity.
What makes
you think that those are the limits of computational creativity, or did that kind of? Why did you feel?
So the reason sentence exists, it becomes also because of like the Oporto like flashy sentences that actually in the beginning don't mean anything, but at the end, like there's this. But it becomes like they're resonant and they start like, you know, but when I was thinking about it, I always thought that, we're going through when I started like my idea, with this collaboration for the natural language.
Mm-hmm.
It was that, I had an idea in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a bit naive with my idea. I thought this could be solved. Also because I work with people that are very fast. Borja is very fast and Luisa is very fast. And people I work there are very fast. Like salt, and it seems that there's no limits. And mm-hmm. and suddenly when you go and you touch science, there's all these protocols and there's all this... you discover there's... You know, the timing is different.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I thought I had some ideas that suddenly I found out that it's not that easy.
Is that because it's sequential?
It's also because like all the ideas I would bring up, you know, of this, I want this not only sequential, but I want like I want to go beyond Brian Geisen's limits.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want just because if it was just random, I could like Borja could do it easily, you know, like I want something, you know, that is based on repetitions, silences, everything that is omitted. You see omitted?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, like suddenly it becomes like omitted senses. This is not senses, but omitted meanings, mm-hmm. you know, like that mm-hmm. actually, and this is why I wanted artificial intelligence involved in that. And when I was working with this, I felt there is, I felt like a limitation of the machine.
It's very interesting that you're saying that
I felt like I really felt I'm working with an incredible first year student. the guy Gonçalo was amazing. Mm-hmm. And really like helpful, and it was very
mm-hmm.
but everything I would ask, you know, nothing, you know, the limit was our poetic capacity of permutating what we're saying, you know, what we were seeing, and mm-hmm. suddenly for that you had to do and pile up several like and crossing several operations, artificial intelligence operations,
mm-hmm.
to match my limited poetic skills. And what was really interesting, it was feeling that what the machine could do, and this I was working also like in editing with Anna, that the machine was amazing giving cues where to go.
Mm-hmm.
But then we felt that, come on, this is becoming like we're doing everything for it. And we're like, we are working here seriously, you know. And so I felt like, he's doing his first year. In 5 years, or if he devoted himself and if he wants to do a PhD just devoted on our work, on my work,
mm-hmm.
we're going to do it, I'm sure. And we're going to, some papers will come out of this because I think it's...
Mm-hmm.
But we have no time.
Mm-hmm.
And so at a certain moment, we said, thank you, machine. We're going to take over. And that's what happened. So we did a small book of those permutations. Mm-hmm. And the idea was to refeed the doing this feedback, the right. machine, with what we actually want. Because
mm-hmm.
what we were doing now in the beginning was the limit, the poem has, it's very limited. And we wanted it to be synthetic. Just work on only with those words. Mm-hmm. Not going.
How many words in total was it?
I don't remember.
What, less than 100?
Yeah. No, I should count them.
Literally just that.
Just that.
But when you were refeeding it in, it was.
I want to refeed with my own permutations that are limited to these words.
Literally all of those.
All those words. But it's infinite because you can repeat, you can repeat, and you can create silences.
Okay.
And there's a lot of stuff that you, it's incredible. It's really, it really mm-hmm. grows. It mm-hmm. really takes you onto another, level.
And Gonzalo must have thought you were mad, right?
And Gonzalo was saying no. It was also no. You're on the opposite. It was always very, helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, it was just a question of time. He has his own projects. It's something that came as a meteor. You know,
mm-hmm.
and why would I leave all my stuff, you know, my comfortable life, just to go through, you know, like you're, you know. And so the idea was, he was not on the same, you know, there, he was not in the, but I guess that I don't see it as a futuristic, provision, or in 5 years, whether we have Gonzalo or not, any machine
mm-hmm.
could do what we were doing here.
Mm-hmm.
Because the aim, what we're aiming is, I think it's going to be very easy because I think they're getting better and better.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and at a certain moment, the limit is our limitations. And that's what I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, you know, a lousy poet. Not even that. And so this is, yeah.
The reason for saying I thought he might have thought you were mad is because normally you train an AI or a machine learning program with the largest corpus, that is the text-to-speech data you can find.
We fed the machine with all Borges.
Okay.
We fed the machine with
PRH
stuff.
So it knew how to speak.
We fed everything, but somehow it was really okay. The machine has all this, but it's so limited.
Right.
It couldn't really work with limitations and with rules we were imposing. But I think in it won't be long to have a machine that can actually work with such a minimal amount of material. So this is what I felt with working goal, and perhaps that's why the limits of I don't remember the sentence, but the limits of computational creativity.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And it goes back to what we were saying in the beginning of the image of the samurai. Is it creative or not? You know, I thought it was not creative at all. That's why I was appropriating and following dumbly the lines of the thing, and then when it was a shock knowing that it was actually done by a grown up artist, a pioneer. Yeah.
So, I mean, is there a sense in that you were kind of following Genesis P. Orridge's work, or his vision of like wanting to break every rule?
Yeah.
I mean, he might have said that. I don't know.
Yeah.
He'd say break every rule on principle. Live to break every rule. Sorry, within AI, was that an intention to try and go against the grain, or was it really an attempt to kind of meet the challenge of trying to produce in artificial infinity?
I think it's more the
second. It's more the second. Tiny, what's effectively
it's more the second, then and I would find out, you know, that there were some coincidences, you know. I was more interested in Brian Geisen for the Dream Machine effect because I'm more a visual person for my thing, and then discovering that actually it was the first or the second, because the first was a technician to do like a permutational a poem using a computer, and so this is something, you know. So, and this is also like one of the interesting things on my work, like that I find interesting working in this field. That some, you know, there's coincidences, like happy coincidences.
It's a very happy one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I thought Genesis P. Orridge is very central, because I mean it's his words, right?
Yeah.
And so Borges is in the background, but you read, well, at least I read it, like there was this kind of stream of actions.
Yeah.
And I think that was also something to do with the way that you'd kept the analog as well. You could have had an artificial voice there, but the sound was very analog. So it sounded like a continuous signal, which kind of lends itself to the infinite in a way as well, right? And just this stream of actions spoke to me of... Buckminster Fuller said, once I seem to be a verb, an evolutionary process.
Okay.
And it kind of... the work expanded in just, I think it was just probably just through that simple choice of using a verb.
Yeah.
And seemed endless. I mean, even if all this was written down without the machinery, it would conjure up that idea. And then the idea possibly as well that, maybe this is going too far, but it was just that we live in these very shallow kind of, these shallow ecologies of where we're evolving through not so much deep thought, the kind of holy grail of AI, where we're trying to constantly mimic our abstract thoughts or the depth of our thinking. But it's actually much more about, like, you know, where are our keys, or, you know, that's what I felt anyway. So there was that, on one level, there was that going on with what seemed to be like quite a deep work.
Yeah.
And then there's the ruined marble, which was a surface like glass cracking. Yeah. And you were kind of, I don't know whether you felt this too, but you were kind of placed in the middle. Like there was a sense that you had to be in that spot where you could see them both at the same time. Mm-hmm. Like you were told to stand there.
Yeah. It's almost like it's an exercise in perspective.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really, it puts you in the, it centers you, it puts you in that, in the right position.
Right.
And what's really interesting is like the main object where everything started is the small object that has a small inclination. For me, it was kind of interesting that somehow when you're looking at it, it's just like, it looks like a, you know, like a cell phone. You put it in the right position to, you know, to see. And then like when you blow up the object at a certain scale, the inclination of it becomes like those fences they use it, the police uses, so that you can't really fall. You know, suddenly it reached this autonomy. It's really protecting itself. It's controlling you somehow. It's kind of that was interesting. I thought, oh, this is the right inclination, you know, so that you can't really. It's not really a screen because the inclination made the piece gain some autonomy. It's a bit difficult to talk about it without seeing the piece, but it's like it's leaning slightly.
Mm-hmm.
But this is also like coincidence, like, you know, like things that I found on a natural way, like trying to find my keys, you know, like on like it's just the practical reasons it had to be with that inclination. Mm-hmm. If not, it would become too vertical. It would become just a regular screen. Mm-hmm. And this, although it's cinematic, it's also sculptural.
Yeah, right.
So it had to have that, you know, just.
Okay, so you're happy to see this work as like a fruitful collaboration with an AI?
I think it's
like a good model, or.
I think it was fruitful,
mm-hmm.
because I was very from the previous experiences I had. It was very it was fruitful in a certain sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wish it could be more. You know, and that the collab. But I don't want to. How do they say, complain. Because also, it's a bit like I was trying, I found out, this is nothing to do with this, but also it has. The piece of stone is a piece of my childhood. It's a bibelot that I've liked. It's always lived with me. And the second is that I found out the person that is running the lab at Technique, it's Louise Coeur, the supervisor of Gonçalo, and she's my childhood friend.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was trying to regain some contact with my friend. Mm-hmm. It's been years, but like I haven't seen her. So this would be like something that, and I think at her level,
mm-hmm.
and she would have time, it would be highly interesting.
Mm-hmm.
To work on something, you know, that would be also fruitful for her.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think for Gonçalo, he didn't have the capacity to understand what he had in hands.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is what the thing that's for. I got the best out of it at this moment. For them, like, you know, for them, I think they could get more.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it was a bit imbalanced, even though it sounds pretentious.
Okay.
I think they should have, man up.
Yeah. Okay. Also,
Sorry, Gonçalo, okay. I know you're not here.
But we're typing this conversation.
Do you want to ask about the...
Maybe the
choice of text for the book. Because you had a conversation with Anna.
That's gone. Yeah.
It's gone.
Okay, right. We can move to another example. No?
Another piece of work?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. So.
We know that you were approached by Orange Company, and they wanted you to explore.
So
do something with that technology?
With AI, actually.
With AI, yeah. Specifically.
Mm-hmm. So. It was because I did some work before, that could be considered art and science. I think that we can talk about it later. But mm-hmm. And so Pompidou was really interested it was a residency. They wanted artists to work with a corporate business, and it was their way of getting pieces in their collection. And so I knew the curator. A curator I really respected. It's mm-hmm. someone that was very, very influenced for me in the 90s, because he was doing the best collection for me of books on conceptual art.
Mm-hmm.
Doing this from nowhere, because he was working in Limousin, a place in nowhere, FRAC, you know. And he was doing like books I was reading in New York. So I trusted this guy, and he was saying, like, I'm working with Pompidou, so let's do something. I know this sounds a bit horrible, but I want you to work with corporate business. And this is, I know, can you talk, the idea would be this, you know, like to be working with a couple of months with them. And I said, I don't know if I have time for that, you know, for this ongoing collaboration. But I would say, okay, let's see what they have to tell me, and if they go along with me and my... particularities.
Mm-hmm.
And so I talked to them. I went to Paris to talk with the technicians of Orange, and it was a bit. I had nothing in mind. I just wanted to know what were they working, and it was a bit frustrating. The conversation, because they had already said what they had, like what I could do. So they were showing me technology that actually was way worse than what you actually could have access, or you'd know that it existed in the internet. So then they were showing their technology, and I felt it was a bit dodgy, all this. And then I found out that actually they were working on Orange. It's not just a company for a phone company. Mm-hmm. It's mainly a security agency that's working for the state, and they were really interested in face recognition, all that shit. And so I said to the curator, I'm not really interested in all this. Mm-hmm. There was another, it's kind of interesting, another artist, the painter, she was working with a bank. And I felt like this kind of like this misunderstanding, like this equivoc, that she was working with this bank. And so I don't know why they wanted her to work, because Orange, they said you can work whatever. And so and she was working, they forced her to work in the bank. So they gave her a space inside of their offices with a glass, like an aquarium. And she said, I'm a smoker. I'm a heavy smoker. And the guy said, okay, you can smoke as much as you want, as long as you work, if you work here. And then the employees of the bank discovered there was a smoking place that was actually her atelier. And she said it was worse than, it was living in the smoking area of the airports for 4 months. So you had like people that were really not interested in her work. Smoking heavily in her, she said, like was the, like I was living in the smog. It was really, so I told this guy, Frederic Paulin, not really interested in working with these conditions, and the guy said, whatever, you know. So we aborted. I did some pieces, but with the Champalimau, because they were also interested in my collaboration with Champalimau. Research center. Mm-hmm. And I said, like, all the technology that Orange can or is willing to show me or to provide me, it's something that I can do better and at home. So I work with João Frazão, is the head of the teaching lab at Champalimau. Because we did some pieces before, and we did actually some interesting pieces that I realized that I was no longer interested in showing it at Pompidou with the name of Orange. So I did another piece with the French flag, with the colors. It worked very well. They love their flag.
Where's that going to be shown?
It was shown at Pompidou.
Okay.
It's part of the collection. Oh, it's The work is on permutations and sound, and I work with Borja Caro on it was working on the analysis of with Max, analyzing an image that was the cover of a Japanese artist that the Japanese artist had done in the 40s for a book of Fantomas, mm-hmm. and it was a modernist. You know, it's a beautiful. Beautiful cover, and I did sort of a game with that, using, it's a bit like this, like bits and pieces that suddenly come together, using as a target or as a structural device, this drawing that actually was a technical device used by or created by Jean Ponvi, a surrealist, mm-hmm. that he used for film technicians to see if the cameras were if the film inside of the cameras was well put. It so it's a target, a mire, they say, a target, mm-hmm. and so I saw that device or that drawing in Greece, in Athens. I got it, was so interested, and then I found out this was done by Jean-Paul V. It's a technical thing. It's like a millimetric paper, like paper. But it's so beautiful. I was really drawn by it. And so this technical apparatus was done by Panlevé not as an artistic piece, but mainly as a technical tool for the guild of the technician, film technicians, because it was the head beyond being the surrealist. It was the head of that association, as you know, he was giving things with his knowledge, creating objects that were actually useful for, and it's a very communist, democratic way of thinking. You know, how can my art be useful or my skills be useful? You know, so I used the Japanese and this guy as the center, as this Piorgen Borges for this piece that was presented, and it now belongs to the collection of Aubourg.
We're wondering whether we're going over time, or because there was another piece that we would like you to tell us the story of in Pockets of Silence, and okay. How it was an amazing coincidence between your artistic research and scientific research.
Okay.
And that's like a very unusual parallel communication to experience.
I think this thing, like I'm glad you're saying about parallel communication, because there's this drawing by Melikash that somehow for me portrays the right equilibrium between the two, like art and science thing.
Yeah.
They really work in these parallel tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And in the drawing of Melikash, they go through this dramatical solid, you know. So, like, it's kind of interesting. But the piece Pockets of Silence started, like, basically, my partner, my wife, Marta Moita, she has this lab at Champalimau, and also that's why I have this privilege of having access to some of their technical facilities. And at the time, she works with fear, and she was like trying hard to see how do rats or female, the mothers, like it's a bit, how do would they transmit fear to the others? And while she was doing, I was doing some research on this weird. What is it called? Mercenaire that was using one of the tactics he was using in guerrilla was using. He found out that silence was the easiest way to get caught in the jungle. So he had like this all these sorts of like sound camouflages. And while I was doing my research on this, she was having this problem with this, like how do rats communicate? And I told her, you know, it might be silence. They're communicating through silence, like almost like applying John Cage into neurosciences. and actually, she tried, you know, and it worked. They were really communicating through silence. And then I used her data to create this piece that is basically on having like two pieces. I use the same software. So I was working with Jean Frazel, having two separate pieces with strong imagery and sound in two separate rooms. And they would communicate, like they would create silences. And so that you would hear them, they would create this like a sort of like this pattern, this solid concrete sound and image. And suddenly you would go and feel the silence. And this silence would become meaningful, fearless, fearful. And so, like, the idea was this, you know, like using how, like, do you have like these two pieces? How do they would communicate to you? There's something weird going on just through, like, just the absence. Yeah. So, and it's kind of interesting that it goes through all this, you know, like we were talking about Borges and the Genesis PR, and how do you, like, you make the poem eternal, mm-hmm. or it's through silence, you know. And also, like, I'm getting, like, drifting. Like, at the end of the show, the machines were very, very, were really tired. And they started to be drunk, mm-hmm. because we were using the samples of PRH to work. And so, at the end, the computer started to become, like, slower and slower, so the image become, like, really, like you know, expanded and expanded. And so at the end, it was just, like, scattered words and silences, you know. So the idea of, like, an eternal poem would be, like, words that could be said every 15 days. Oh. Something like that. So, yeah, so... Okay. So the idea of silence was, with Marta, where I was working, was kind of interesting because... We actually, at that time, we touched, you know, and it was really interesting that some, like, it was meaningful for both mm-hmm. what we were doing, you know. I was really also trying to having really problems solving my own work mm-hmm. because I didn't want to be a slave to the story of this horrible mercenary, like, using, like, weird tactics, you know.
But one of the tactics was just to broadcast
sound yeah,
in the jungle,
in the jungle
to mask
the silences of the forest.
All right.
So they found out that every time they would get in the forest, the forest becomes silent, and they were always ambushed. Mm-hmm. This was in 1963. I don't want to go through this,
but it worked, right?
It worked.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
I think that maybe is a good point to maybe open the discussion to the public. Yeah, I just, as a wrap up, that's like I come out of this idea, I come out of this conversation with a really strong idea, which is incredible how you are so attuned to coincidences. Yes,
mm-hmm.
And you find those coincidences because you are able to choose from everything that can be coincidental. Those who are and meaningful,
mm-hmm.
yeah. So, like, an unmeaningful coincidence is nothing, yeah.
Yeah.
And what AIs can do now is find all possible coincidences and all possible patterns between things.
Okay.
But they still cannot understand anything about the meaning of those.
Yeah.
So that would be the limits of computation.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Is the meaning part?
Yes, completely.
Let's keep that with us humans, and then find interesting ways of collaborating with these AIs, which is what you seem to be doing really well.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Thanks so much. Here we go. Two questions, please. I don't want to start with a long non-question, so I'll try to keep it really simple. I know that material relations are really important to your work, especially because you depend on messing up with cognition. So the material...
I depend on?
On messing with cognition.
Okay.
So the material of the piece gets in an almost direct and confused relation with the viewer.
Okay.
Some days I think I'm going to ask it today. Would you consider yourself an animist?
Oh.
And the second question, and I'll go away. In this new piece, The Third Reason, who do you think that learned something?
Yeah, I don't know. As an animist, I find it interesting. I wish I would be. Because I'm sort of a disbeliever and all that. I try not to be that cynical, and I wish I could be recently my daughter read this Valérie Solano, the manifesto, the Scum manifesto, and she was saying that every work of made by man is spiritual and profound. So I wish being out of that profoundness, So my idea is that it's very difficult to find the right equilibrium, not to get into the I feel sometimes that I'm dealing with stuff that I really don't control. Mainly, it's not that profound, like the AI. I know nothing about AI. And sometimes I feel, but there's some stuff that we're saying, going through, not trying to escape from it, that I love. In the beginning, I was like working with the definition of Ezra Pound about what an image is, like this gradient nod where ideas fall. I feel that sometimes there's stuff, and I'm a true believer in art history. There are things really that really are compelling, like really are like drag me in. And I wish, sometimes when I see stuff that my things, could trap me in as other things can do. Yeah. So it's, I don't know if, what the second question? I don't know if, So third reason. At a certain, understand. I think I learned a lot. I learned a lot in the writing process, how it works. But also, I think there is quite interesting how like these operations sometimes reveal things that are really unexpected. But this can like work on a. This can work on any poetry, But the thing is there, it's an experiment. And if it was well done and controlled, I think I could go, like, beyond. The thing, I was not well supervised. So my, like, I think it's just like, I don't know if I will ever be able to write any poetry. Scientifically, definitely not. Like aesthetic, poetically, also definitely not. But like according to the image, I think if I'm going to continue working with machines like this, I think it could be really interesting. What I want is with this knowledge to go back to more base, because I feel I'm contaminated. And if, like, in the learning process, I feel more contaminated than anything, at approaching like a drawing or something, I will have all that, accumulated knowledge. So, but I want to go to something more connected to the roots, simple things. But I have the, I don't know. I always felt like the conceptual art. Conceptual arts in the way that it was in the beginning thought by Henry Flint, it was a mathematical way of approaching art, and by doing this, it was opening up a way of analyzing it. It was just like it's paving the way to get into it, just to analyze and to replicate it, And I still feel the same.
The fact that you're using the meditative, is that a kind of reaction to that kind of type of conceptual art that assumes that the spectator is also rational too? Are you deliberately working against that model? Because, there are examples in post-minimal work and art prevera maybe even where that is a strategy. But in your case, is that one?
I think what is really interesting is that, like a way of not quantifying things, right. But knowing it's the possibility of quantification and how, if it's possible to shield it, against, I don't know. But I don't work in reaction to anything. I just feel like any image has its own problem. It's like that I try to solve.
Any more questions from the floor?
So you work with AI. Does it feel that you're outsourcing your creativity to AI? You make a work of art.
You feed AI some input, I'm assuming. And AI basically does its own cognitive process on it.
Okay.
And then out comes something funky. Do you feel that you have creative input into the system? I mean, in principle, for example, if somebody else, for example, not you, came along and, say, Gonzalo came along and gave a different kind of input to this AI, it would also produce some kind of output, which would be a piece of work.
Yeah.
So is there a sense in which you're saying, oh, I'm just going to be this manager?
No, there's two things here going on. The AI is part... It's part of the work. Like it's a part of the work. You know, I'm working with projection. I'm working with like there's a lot of elements, and AI is part of it. I think it's meaningful. You know, but if I would go to another place, perhaps like another context, I would be starting working with like talking about something else, like the idea of mirror. You know, the reflection of the image, how I use the acrylic, how I'm using the remainings of the handmade making of a mirror. The idea, I like this idea of, as you're saying, you know, where does the creativity, where the outsourcing of creativity. I feel it's really thrilling to think, like, I think it's meaningful for me. It resonates that idea, you know. And I'm questioning myself, you know, how far can I go? And what would be the difference between Gonzalo and... But also, if you go to permutational... and this goes back to the beginning of the conversation. I don't know if Brian Geisen is or not the first artist to work with the permutational poems. Apparently, it's the second one. The first... is a technician. And the thing is, why is there, I think it's kind of also the reason why when I started the idea of the image I used for as a portrait of myself here, that I thought that was, the image is so, so uninteresting that by tracing it, I felt always like it's a ridiculous act, but it really rang the bell, you know, the idea of the first drawing made by ordinateur, you know, and this is why, if it wasn't interesting, I wouldn't be like talking about it 20 years after, you know, so it stayed on me. I don't know if it's interesting for you guys or not, but for me, it's something that stayed. So this idea of outsourcing creativity, I don't know. I think I framed it. So the structure is mine. It works in certain things that I think are really, it's yeah, and so.
Can we repeat that?
Sorry, the difference between the engineer and Brian Geisen is that the engineer was just showing the possibilities of the machine, and Geisen was actually trying to make poetry
out of it. So actually, it's what ended the, and we were saying in the beginning. So the machine here, with its own limitations, suggested. Like, and so after that, yeah. Yeah. But I know my creative choice was done because lack of resources. Yeah. So, yeah.
And it's also, if we're really worried or want to find the limits of creativity and to work out what can we outsource to machines, it could be useful to start with a shared definition of creativity, because sometimes is not, we might mean different things, yeah? Like the most common limited definition of creativity is just to combine two familiar ideas in unfamiliar ways, yes? And that, in terms of computational strategies, I think AIs and computers can do that. But the second stage of creativity is also to, from all of those possible combinations, unfamiliar combinations of familiar things, which ones are relevant? And that is already a bit more difficult for computers to do. Then you have another type of creativity, which is to play within a certain style, yeah? Like you could create an impressionistic painting or something. And that we've also been training AIs to do that. And the deepest form of creativity is to actually, after you exceed the limits of a certain style, to be able to create a new one, which of course needs to also be relevant. And that, as we stand, cannot be outsourced. And apologies for being a bit...
No, I think it was incredible.
educational.
No, it was very good.
It's important to clarify what we mean by creativity as well.
Right. Hi. So the difference between the engineer and the Brian Giesen, was it? Brian Giesen, was that there was some intent there, right? I mean, you can in principle throw up a bunch of balls up in the air and produce and let them fall on the ground and produce a fantastic pattern. If the balls splatter and they're paintballs. And there are people who probably do art like that. It's called creative because presumably they go to exhibitions and people pay money for them. But there is some kind of structured intention sometimes behind it. Like maybe the guy wants to choose some of this art. So from what you're saying, presumably is that there is an element of choice there. Intent, more importantly. And the question which I was curious about was, AIs function on some algorithms at the end of the day. And so intent is, or purpose is just programming at the end of the day. So do you personally think of this programming as the same as, I don't know, human intent? Do you think of it as sacrosanct as human intent at this stage as an artist? Maybe a computer scientist has a different definition. That was probably what my question was leading up to. Yeah, that was totally unclear, sorry.
Sophia, please.
No.
Come on.
No, I don't. I don't compare it, no, especially because of what I said at the end of this conversation, because of the meaning, yeah. So you can fake intent, yes, but I don't know if that passes as the same thing.
Thank you. I want to chime in on this theme, because you spoke about the intent. And,
No, I think it's cool.
Obrigado, Alexandre, desculpa.
No, it's really cool.
Também já estás cansado, não é?
No, I'm really enjoying it.
You spoke about intent, and I was reminded of intentionality. At the end of the day, as you were saying, I think that intentionality lies in the viewer, in the beholder, because what it is about will be a decision or a propensity to a decision that... That lies in the viewer and never on the work. The work may be creative coming from an engineer, and the work may be creative coming from an artist. But its aboutness will be only communicated and understood. And this is the key concept for me, understood by the viewer. Thus closing or half closing this feedback loop.
Just because we are getting into the topic of creativity, and I wanted to chime in on your opinion as well. It's just that I find it really interesting because obviously, even with in this case, the AI is your method. It is the way that you are using to express it, and of course, your control over that is limited, and that's what is interesting. But I think, at least to me, that they're usually a really relevant intention over what you're doing, because I don't think it's just on the part of the viewer or the watcher or whoever is hearing or watching it. So I'm curious, like, what amount of control you have it over, you know, what you want to express, how well you can do it through the AI. Your original intention what you actually mean.
So I think it's what I wanted to, my idea for there, like, you know, from the, I wanted just to expand the formula right from the beginning. And I wanted to see what could the, but the thing was presented in a certain framework, you know, it's the frame set by the piece itself. That is, in its case, it's just like it's the display and the relation the viewer has with it. And so I believe like what Philippe was saying is also that it's something that that exists. And I always try to see myself at the end as the ultimate viewer of the work. But I love the idea on this idea of like autonomy, you know, that the work, while we're talking here, the machine, even though we're not, I don't really know what's producing, it continues doing highly, highly interesting and poetic, like a highly interesting poetic stream or not. And I love it. It's doing it, but also understanding that the thing, when we listen to it, it becomes like an oracle. Sometimes it's really highly uninteresting, you know, and through like it, this highly uninterestingness, you know, also almost like the silence, you give meaning to its poor, like, to the poor performance of it, you know, and so somehow you're always, you know, trying to find, and if the machine suddenly stops, you know, I don't know really if it was intentional or if it was a malfunction. And I really feel that's really, like, you know, my effort to fill that gap, you know, is for me, it's meaningful, you know, so it's, and sometimes it puts me in, you know, like it alters my state of, you know, and the way I my relation with objects, and I don't even know if that what I'm seeing is an object or not. It's an in-between thing. It's a matter. It's memory, and it's concrete by perception. But the idea of having and seeing this like strange entity, you know. Be like animistic or not, you know, and the idea it becomes like in this phenomenological approach to it, it's one of the things that drags me into doing like more pieces and trying new formulas, so new operations. Of course, I do my own operations every time, you know, and I do repetitions and I go through style, you know, and I try somehow to do tabula rasa of the last one, you know, just to expand my, you know, my horizons and my territory. If not, I would be doing the same thing every time. So I give some space to discoveries. And if I don't know if they can be done by chance, by something, you know, that fell, or by an old friend I haven't seen for years, by a stone that is in my bookshelf, by a conversation, you know, I had with friends, you know, for the limitations of the machine and what is being promoted about AI, that I want to know what's going on, you know. So, and the fear about it, and the silence and the connection of fear and silences and all that, you know, I think everything is, can be, that's it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you.